My name is Roy Malloy, and you're listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast dedicated to the faces, the places, and the people who have committed the crimes that have made Australia the uniquely fascinating landscape of criminality and justice that has become this wonderful country. I'm talking today with Dr. Mark St. Leon, a prolific author and one of the most interesting authors in the country today, who's written a staggering array of books that biography some of Australia's greatest circus artists, including the fantastic Wizard of the Wire, the story of Conculliano, the biography of Mae Worth, a series of more generic circus biographies that look at the entire list of circus histories in the country. But today I'm going to be talking to Dr. Mark St. Leon about a particular case which piqued my interest and curiosity many, many years ago when I was reading some of his earlier works. The case of one of Australia's most flamboyant but celebritised individuals at a time. But I'll introduce Dr. Mark. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Roy. Pleasure to be here.
And I'll ask a leading question. What got you into writing circus biographies and circus histories?
Well, before I even got into writing circus biographies and circus histories, I had to have my interest in the subject matter piqued. And that came about because I was blessed with this peculiar surname, St. Leon, and nobody would tell me where the name came from. Nobody could tell me where it came from. And about the age of 17, my curiosity got the better of me. And I started drilling down, going through colonial newspapers, writing letters here and there, and established without too much trouble that the name was simply a pseudonym that had been adopted by my great-great-grandfather for his circus. And over time, the name eventually became the accepted family name. By the time I came along, fifth generation, its origins had just been about forgotten. So things rolled on from there, and what I'd really stumbled across, although I didn't quite realise it at the time, was a whole corner of Australia's history, the history of travelling entertainments, which had virtually been left untouched by even Australia's eminent historians. And it's consumed me ever since.
Do you feel that comes partly from the sanitised British style history that Australia has, where if it's not proper, it's not proper, and we don't tell stories perhaps as well as the Americans do, who will grab hold of anything to sensationalise it?
That could be something to do with it. I think Australia, the study of Australia, serious study of Australian history, really only came into its own, I think, in the 1950s and the 60s, when you had people like Manning Clark and Geoffrey Blainey. You had the launch of the Australian Dictionary of Biography. And people of that era began to look quite objectively at Australia's history. But I guess, you know, I think even Manning Clark accepts the fact that he largely ignored the Aboriginal element to Australian history. There was, I guess, just a limit to the amount of work that even a few people could do. And of course, in those times, I'm talking about 50 or 60 years ago, they don't have the connectivity and the archival resources that we have today. Things, you just tap a few things on your keyboard and you can call up information from virtually anywhere in the world.
True. So, and I think you hit the nail on the head a little bit. Some of the Aboriginal stories, or almost all the Aboriginal stories that, you know, came and went, they weren't recorded in ways that we find easy to access now. That would have to be said true also to a lot of circus histories, and that they're kind of circus artifacts. You don't see them in antique shops very often. And I was fortunate enough to talk to Doug Ashton about it. And I said to him, why don't you see them in antique shops? He said, because when they break, mate, we throw them away. It was such a transient culture that even their own stories weren't preserved well.
Yeah, that's right. Very few of the circus families kept detailed records. Partly to do with the demands of travelling. Things would get lost. Things would get swamped in floods or burnt in bushfires. Things just get lost and forgotten along the way. I know in my own family that a whole wealth of photographs and memorabilia has been lost along the way. The compensating thing was the fact that wherever the circuses went, they left a trail of their activities in contemporary newspapers. So you can trace the movements of a circus through the advertising and the critiques that were quite often very nicely written up in colonial and earlier 20th century newspapers.
What then that raises the question, what first made you aware of the story of Omar Kingsley, who was also El Zoyara?
Well, I came across, as I proceeded with my research, and the early years of my research, I was really just sort of fumbling in the bush. I didn't know, because I had no guideposts or milestones to tell me, look there or look that. I sort of had to fumble from one old newspaper to another old newspaper and try and work out what it was all about. But one of the circuses that did come to my attention was a circus that visited here from the United States in 1866. And the name of that circus was Cook, Zoyara, and Wilson. It was a partnership of three circus men who formed their circus in California just after the end of the Civil War. And during the Civil War, I might mention that shipping services and even trade and commercial links with the United States had virtually dropped to zero. So in the aftermath of the Civil War, there was a resurgence of trade and commerce and communications across the Pacific. And Cook, Zoyara, and Wilson thought it would be a good idea to take a circus down to Australia, which they did. And so the name, Cook, Zoyara, and Wilson, came to my attention quite early on. It sort of always remained in my mind, that name, the twang about it, the name Zoyara. And then maybe a few years after that, I met an English circus historian called Anthony Hippisley Cox, very famous English circus historian. And he was in Sydney, and he very kindly gave me a copy of his book called A Seat at the Circus, which is a very serious look at circus acts and circus performances and so on. And as I skimmed through the book when I got home, out pops this name, Zoyara, with details of Ella Zoyara, who was, despite her female name, was in fact a man who had been born in, I think, New Orleans, a Creole, about the year 1835, and had been born with the name Omar Kingsley. And Omar Kingsley had been apprenticed to a circus man, as kids often were in those days, apprenticed to a circus man called Spencer Stokes. And Spencer Stokes had the idea of training Omar Kingsley not to be a male rider, but to be a female rider. See, one of the problems you had in the circus in those days was finding sufficient numbers of attractive young female riders. There were plenty of male riders, but for whatever reason, females were kept away from circus careers. So Spencer Stokes had the idea, well, I'll get this little boy and I'll train him from the ground up to adopt all the mannerisms, the style, and even the dress of a female performer, so that when he's a fully fledged equestrian by the late teens or early 20s of his life, we'll be able to pass him off as the world's greatest lady circus rider. So that's what they did, and he was given or renamed with the name Ella Zoyara, and started to wow and ingratiate audiences throughout the United States, and was even taken over to Europe, performed there. And little Ella Zoyara, aka Omar Kingsley, started receiving all sorts of proposals of marriage, and not only from your regular audience goers, but even from princes and I think one or two kings amongst them. So
back a little bit. A big part of the appeal here is also, we say now, all right, a guy dressed as a male dresses as a female. It's not shocking or even novel at this point in time, but there's a couple of layers of novelty in the creation of one of them is that, and tell me if I'm wrong, it was absolutely inconceivable to the human public that a woman could do the equestrian tricks on the back of a running horse that a man could. Also, I mean, there's precedence. We know that there were men dressing as women in pantomime, but it wasn't designed to really trick the audience, I guess you'd say, to being a woman. You'd get things like the minstrels, where a man would wear a mop on his head and pretend to be a woman, but it was grotesque. It wasn't truly endeavouring to represent the person of the opposite gender to their birth gender.
Yeah, I think I don't know if the term is still in vogue, but it used to be called dressing in drag when men dressed up to look like and appear as women.
And it was shocking. I mean, it was highly illegal because some of the crimes you could be charged with in offensive behaviour is a good one. And that's anybody that's offended by your behaviour, you are then committing offensive behaviour. But contemporarily at this time, is Edward de Lacy Evans a part, we're talking 1860s, 70s, is Zoyara earlier than that?
Well, Ella Zoyara, she would have come to, you keep saying she, but I say that advisedly. She came to prominence in the 1850s, pre-Civil War America, before she was taken over to Europe and then came back.
So what period did she come to Australia?
She landed here as part of the Cook, Zoyara and Wilson Circus Triumvirate in 1866.
Okay, so by that stage, she's famous enough that she's, typically what I've been taught is to refer to the person as she when she is portraying herself as female and he when he is representing himself as male. So at that point, by the time Ella Zoyara arrives in Australia, nobody has any idea that her birth gender is male. And she's successful enough that she's got a naming interest in the circus, am I right?
That's right. She's a co-owner, a partner in the circus.
And had anybody in the previous countries they had performed in, had nobody ever put two and two together?
To the best of my knowledge, no. I don't have any instance of that. She managed to beguile audiences throughout the United States and Europe, continental Europe. For several years. As far as I'm aware, everybody was taken in by the disguise.
Okay, and so then where did...
This probably goes back to the effectiveness of Spencer Stokes' training, the way he meticulously paid attention to the cultivating this feminine style of riding, the flourishes and the flushes, the dress, etc., to make it look as realistic as possible.
Am I right in understanding that he, even as a small child, he dressed Omar Kingsley as a girl and raised this small child with his own daughters?
That's right.
As a daughter. So it was a... I mean, the levels of psychology that they would play on this poor bloke. She arrives in Australia with her circus. Whereabouts were they performing?
They landed in Sydney, March 1866. The circus actually stopped over in New Zealand, Honolulu and Auckland on the way, but landed in Sydney in March 1866. And they took a vacant block of land, as they were in Sydney at that time, a vacant block of land not far from where the Sydney General Post Office stands, and proceeded to erect a circus, as I gather, not a tented circus, but a pavilion circus, would have been probably timber and corrugated iron, maybe with a canvas rooftop, and proceeded to play there in Sydney to quite a popular reception, bearing in mind that this was the first American, indeed foreign, circus that had visited Australia for about 7 or 8 years.
Nobody was any the wiser. And I keep asking that question because the danger she faced, as we've seen with lots of cases in Australian history, even up until the 1970s, where men dressed as women or women dressed as men, they were jailable offences with hard labour included. Up to 2 years, you get a long period in the slammer just for walking down the street dressed in the wrong attire. The Sydney engagement where they're, again, she's not found out. Where did the wheels come off it?
Well, the wheels never came off it in Australia, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know. The audience was quite taken. It was no doubt a secret, well-kept secret amongst the circus people. One of my elderly uncles I spoke to many years ago, because in my own family we did have a female impersonator, circus rider, Philip Sutherland, who used to dress up as Senorita Filipina. This is about the year 1914, 1915, 1916. Anyway, talking to my uncle about Senorita Filipina, he told me that a perceptive person could see that it was a male because of the strength of the legs, pumping action, jumping on and off the horse. That would be obvious to a skilled observer of circus acts. But as far as the general public is concerned, I have found no reference in Australia at that time to Zoyara being uncovered or unmasked for her real identity as a male rider. And they went to extraordinary lengths. It was not only appearing in the ring as Ella Zoyara, but outside of the circus during the daytime, maybe walking down George Street in Sydney, everybody would point out, oh, there's Ella Zoyara. She played the role to the hilt.
Extraordinary. So after their Australian tour, where do they get head off to, and where does this become really something that we now remember more than just a female equestrian?
Right. Well, Cook, Zoyara, and Wilson—they continued their colonial tour. And when we're talking about 1866, Australia's population at that time was only about maybe 2 million people, maybe probably not even that. So there wasn't too many places where you could bring a reasonably large circus. I wouldn't say Cook, Zoyara, and Wilson's was a huge circus, but by colonial standards, it was quite a large affair. So there are only limited places they could go from Sydney, one of which was to go northwards towards Brisbane, but that was a pretty tough hike up through New England, or down south along what was called the Great South Road in the direction of Melbourne. But they did get down to Melbourne and... business overtook them, and there was some fight or dispute amongst the partners in the show. And before you know it, Cook, Zoyara and Wilson Circus went into liquidation, and they split their partnership. Cook went one way, and Zoyara and Wilson went another. They took what remained of the circus. They took it by boat, of course, to India, and commenced to tour India and the ports of the various colonial dependencies of South Asia.
They were very militarized, weren't they? They were heavily militarized at that stage.
I'm sorry?
All those parts of India and South Asia, there was a lot of military tussle going on.
Yeah, well, India at that time was... certainly under British rule, most decidedly after the putting down the Indian Mutiny of 1857. But don't forget there were French colonies in Indochina and other British colonies such as Singapore and Malaya, Hong Kong and so on. And of course, China was under a good deal of subjugation by the treaty powers. So all sorts of possibilities and for a circus. And of course, the Western style of circus was a novelty for people in South Asia. Hardly any Western circuses had been through South Asia at that time. So they did cause quite a furor wherever they went. But where things came apart is when they reached Manila, which of course, the Philippines, which of course at that time was under Spanish rule. And something went haywire there that caused the Spanish authorities to arrest Wilson and Zoyara, and they were thrown into jail. At this time, they had not suspected Zoyara's feminine put on or show, whatever you're going to call it. But when she was put in jail, she was required to undress and show everything. That's when the Spanish jail authorities, to their amusement, found that they hadn't arrested a woman, they had arrested a man. And so the ruse was uncovered, and the news spread throughout the world that Ella Zoyara, in fact, was not a female rider. She was, in fact, a man. And it further became known that her real name was, in fact, Omar Kingsley. So after that affair, we don't hear anything of Ella Zoyara. Instead, Omar Kingsley reverted to being just a regular male rider, and he still maintained his association with John Wilson. And when Wilson's circus was reorganized back in San Francisco, visited Australia again in 1876, oh, who should come along for the ride but Omar Kingsley, who was Wilson's ringmaster and also presented fine trained horses in the circus ring, and just did regular male type riding acts. About that time, Omar Kingsley married. I believe he fathered two children. Wilson took his circus on to India again. And it's there, sadly, in 1879, that Omar Kingsley died, caught up in one of the cholera epidemics that were the scourge of India during those times. And that was the end of Omar Kingsley, a.k.a. Ella Zoyara.
It's fascinating how history repeats itself. We see a similar the story of Eugenie Fellini, who was Italian female, and for various reasons dresses as a man. And it's that exact moment where she's accused of something. She's in the police station, and they said, we're going to haul you away to jail. She says to the police, well, there's something I've got to tell you before you do that. It's a fascinating repeat we've seen a few times in history with people who choose to dress in the opposite gender to their birth gender. In the legacy of Omar Kingsley, did it have much bearing on when Omar came back to Australia? Was there a lot of talk about, like, did the Australian public put together this was Ella Zoyara?
It did become public knowledge. It filtered through the show business columns of the newspapers and various show business magazines, but then it was forgotten. But if there was a legacy that Ella Zoyara left, it was the fact that this was a very expedient way to overcome the shortage of female riders. It's one thing that circus audiences appreciated in those days were fine, attractive, capable female circus riders, but they were in very short supply. So you find in Australian circus, and I'm sure you find in American circus as well, there was this sort of a little trickle of comely, we might say, young men being dressed up in female attire, bewigged, learning to do the female style of presentation, the flourishes and so on horseback, and being presented to the audience as female riders. Some I can name. One was a fellow called Ernest McMurtry, who went under the name Ernie Shand, and he was featured in Fitzgerald Brothers Circus about the turn of the 19th century. Fitzgerald Brothers Circus, long forgotten now, but it was Australia's biggest circus in those days. Ernest Shand, whose correct name was Ernest McMurtry, he was apprenticed to Fitzgerald Brothers Circus. He was given the professional name of Ernie Shand, which was incidentally the name of a famous music hall comedian in London. And then Fitzgerald Brothers decided, well, we're short of female riders and female trapeze artists, so we're going to have to dress you up as a girl and present you in some acts in that capacity. So you have this Ernie Shand, he's appearing in one act as Ernie Shand, but then goes back into the green room, changes for another act and reappears in the ring as Daisy Shand, female circus rider par extraordinaire. And Ernie Shand also appeared as a female trapeze artist in a little trapeze troupe, the Flying Meteors that appeared in Fitzgerald Brothers Circus about 1903.
Was the public ever complaining about this?
Public, I don't think the public ever realised. I've never found any reference. Somebody might have suspected, but I don't think... you see, the public is sitting in the audience a fair way from the action. The action is happening quickly. Unless you're actually looking for these things, I don't think you'd notice them.
And I think that is a huge part of it, is that people, there was just no precedence where people had said, this is what you really think is a woman is actually a man. That had never happened prior to this, really, had it?
But that you could say that's the entire circus ambient, you know, the fancy names given to performers, the fancy costumes, the drum rolls and things to present the acts. It's all part of the build-up, the staging of this this ambience to, I won't say fool the audience, although there is elements to that, but to captivate the audience, having them believe what they would like to believe.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Mark St. Leon. It's been yet again fascinating. Every time I've chatted with you, I've learned something different. If you have never come across any of Dr. Mark St. Leon's books, do make sure you check them out. Again, I will highly recommend The Wizard of the Wire, the Concagliano story, among his amazing books. Also, in the meantime, do check out The Dawn of Crime on Facebook and anywhere you can find the book series. Otherwise, Roy Malloy, author, is also a page that I have on Facebook to help promote some of these incredible stories. Thank you for joining us today on The Dawn of Crime, Dr. Mark St. Leon. It's been a pleasure having you.